You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by
law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. No one compliments you when their paycheck is correct, but make one mistake and you risk alienating your entire workforce. Kronos makes sure your payroll is done right the first time, from punch to paycheck. With embedded checklists and simplified workflows, Kronos is your single source of truth. With Kronos, you get HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/payroll. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Chris Christie has never been one to mince words, not as the corruption-busting U.S. attorney for New Jersey, not during his 8 years as that state's governor, not as a presidential candidate in the 2016 Republican primary, and not even after he dropped out of that race, endorsing his opponent for the nomination, the equally brusque Donald Trump. A friend of Trump's for 15 years, he quickly became one of Trump's most trusted advisors and perhaps the only person who could speak bluntly to the future president and explain difficult truths without sugarcoating it. Tasked with running Trump's transition team, Christie was nearly named his running mate. But within days of Trump's surprise victory over Hillary Clinton, Christie was in for his own surprise. He was being booted out. But now, Chris Christie is getting the last word in his new memoir titled Let Me Finish: Trump, the Kushners, Bannon, New Jersey, and the Power of In-Your-Face Politics. And on today's podcast, he sets the record straight about his tenure as a prosecutor and a Republican running a Democratic state, as well as what really happened on the 2016 campaign trail and inside Trump Tower. He recalls how his friendship with Donald Trump began long ago and the nasty details of the infamous Charles Kushner case that would one day come back to haunt him. He talks about why he passed on running for president in 2012, Hurricane Sandy, and that notorious Obama hug, which he says wasn't really a hug, and how the Romney campaign used that picture as a scapegoat for their own candidate's defeat. We also get into the George Washington Bridge scandal. He says he even had to convince his own son that he had nothing to do with it. And in the end, it boiled down to stupid people doing stupid things. I ask him if he thinks the Trump-Russia collusion could turn out to be something similar to that. He says he could tell General Mike Flynn was trouble from day one. He talks about his former colleagues, Bob Mueller and James Comey, and he shares the advice he gave Donald Trump when the whole Russia investigation began. He reveals why he believed he was going to be tapped as Trump's running mate, how Jared Kushner tossed out the entire Trump transition plan just to get even with him, and the day Chris Christie finally got fed up with all the sycophants and backstabbers around the president and said, "I'm done." Plus, how he became the first YouTube governor, why he unfollowed every New Jersey reporter on Twitter, and why it took him 3 months to convince Donald Trump to cash his check. Coming up with former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in just a moment. Chris Christie served as the United States Attorney for New Jersey and New Jersey Governor from 2010 to 2018. During his tenure, he chaired the Republican Governors Association and President Trump's Opioid and Drug Abuse Commission. Nowadays, he's a political contributor on ABC News, and he's recently written a new memoir called Let Me Finish: Trump, the Kushners, Bannon, New Jersey, and the Power of In-Your-Face Politics.
There we go.
Governor Christie, welcome.
Ben, happy to be here.
Being on the book tour again, does it feel like you're back on the campaign trail a little bit?
It definitely does. It's been, you're catching me at the end of two solid weeks of travel and media appearances and book signings, and it's been just great. The reaction to the book has been great. We're thrilled. We're number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list in our first week, and so it's been really great reception. All of it does feel a bit reminiscent of campaigning.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, and I have to say, you know, it's one of the best political memoirs I've read over the past few years. But the one thing that struck me is here you are, you're releasing it in February of 2019 when all the Democrats who are going to run in 2020 are putting out books. Why didn't you put this out in 2016? I think it might have helped you.
Wasn't permitted to. New Jersey is the only state in the nation where the governor is not allowed to publish a book while you're in office.
No kidding.
Yeah, ethical restriction on doing that. And so I was not able to do it while I was governor. And so I had to wait until after I was done.
New Jersey has had its issues with public corruption, so
yep.
I guess they have to be pretty strict.
They are.
Well, you know, I think that I'm not alone when I was surprised that you endorsed Trump in 2016, and it seemed like you were spending more time focusing on Marco Rubio and Jeb and Ted Cruz than on Trump in the debates. But I didn't realize that you two have had this friendship going back, what, close to 2 decades, probably?
Yes, it's 17 years now. I've been friends with the president. But that wasn't really the issue in the campaign. It wasn't that, you know, he's a friend, so I wasn't going to spend time on him. If you recall the dynamic of that race, Trump was kind of off on a category of his own. And then there was, you know, another category of the governors or the traditional mainstream candidates, like me, Jeb, Marco, Cruz, John Kasich. And everybody wanted a one-on-one shot at Trump. And, you know, if you went at him too early, he knocked you down pretty badly. You look at Rand Paul and a few other folks who decided to get aggressive. Rick Perry decided to get aggressive real early, and they got slapped around by Trump. So I think all of us were trying to figure out if we could win the semifinal, that, you know, we get into the finals against Trump, we take him on one-on-one. Never happened that way, but that was the thought behind it.
Yeah, and if nothing else, you got one really good hit in on Marco Rubio when you called him out for his robotic repeat of that one line in that one debate.
It was a pretty incredible moment. It was something that we knew Marco was prone to do, to memorize things that his advisors told him to say. And so we felt pretty strongly that we could display that for the entire country that was watching that night, and we were successful at doing it.
You had kind of carved out this niche for yourself in the GOP as the East Coast guy, from blue state Republican, who was brash, tells it like it is, doesn't put up with a lot of BS. Then Trump comes along. To what extent did you feel like you kind of got out Chris Christied?
I did.
Yeah.
I mean, not to an extent, I did. And, you know, it's tough when the guy who does that has a, you know, top 10 rated television show for the last decade.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way to compete with that and his money. And so I felt like we did it better, but we weren't going to have the opportunity to show.
Well, I want to go back to this early friendship that you had with the president. There's this great story in here about a time early in your friendship when you're the U.S. attorney for New Jersey and Trump sets up this anniversary dinner for you and your wife, Mary Pat, at Le Cirque. And I think it says so much about the way you operate and also about the way he operates. Can you tell that one?
Sure. He set up this reservation. We were supposed to go to a different restaurant of his, and the restaurant was closed. And so he said, no, well, don't worry about it. I set this up at Le Cirque, and it was for Mary Pat's 40th birthday. And so we went there, and we had a wonderful meal. And at the end of dinner, I said to the waiter, you know, okay, just I need a check. And he said, sure, and he walked away. And then the maitre d' came back and said, there's no check tonight. Mr. Trump is taking care of it. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm the United States Attorney for New Jersey. I can't accept anything like that. So you need to bring a check. And he said, Mr. Christie, I don't care who you are, to tell you the truth, Mr. Trump's a very good customer, and he has told me that he is taking care of the check. And so that's that. And I said, well, bring me the menu back. So he brought me the menu back, and I took down the prices of all the things that we had to eat. and added a healthy tip. And then when I got home that night, I wrote him a check and I wrote him a note saying, like, listen, encloses a check for dinner. I appreciate the gesture, but I am not ethically able to accept that. And you say you want to be my friend. If you want to be my friend, you'll cash the check. And it took 3 months and eventually talking to him on the phone where he had told me he framed the check because it was the first check he had ever gotten from a public figure. And he thought it was just so great. He showed it to me. But I said, well, take the check out of the frame, make a Xerox of it and cash the check. And finally, the third month, he cashed the check.
After
and
so, 3 months.
3 months of 3 months of pestering him.
Now, I think that you say it was his sister who introduced the two of you and you struck up this friendship. What do you think his interest was in you at that early on?
Donald is a collector of people. Mm-hmm. And so when he sees someone that he thinks might have a chance to be successful or important, he likes to get to know them. And I've seen him do this over the years since I was collected back in 2002. And I think that was it. I think he saw someone who was the new U.S. attorney, and he thought it was a great idea for he and I to get to know each other. And it turned out to be a really great idea. We've had a great relationship.
Looking back at those early days, could you have ever imagined the impact that Donald Trump and the Kushners would have on your own political fortunes?
No. It's when you read the story, if this were a novel, no one would believe it. this twist and turn of these relationships and the serendipity that's involved here is just breathtaking. But it all happened. And no, I never would have had any guess of the impact that Donald or the Kushner family would have on my career.
Yeah, Charles Kushner was far from one of the biggest cases that you had had. I mean, you had prosecuted, I think, 130 public corruption cases,
yep.
Terrorists, I'm assuming probably a mobster or two.
Always in New Jersey, yeah. Absolutely. Drug dealers and gang members and all kinds of really very interesting, you know, fascinating cases. Charles Kushner was just another one of the 130 public figure corruption cases that we did. Over the course of my 7 years without a defeat, and it did not seem. Listen, it was noteworthy at the time; it got a lot of publicity, but I never knew it would have the impact on my life long term that it did.
Now you have a chapter in here called YouTube Governor. You became famous for tussling with reporters and Democrats in press conferences and public appearances. Do you feel like you bear any responsibility for what you call in the title the in-your-face politics we have now?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. And
do you think that's a bad thing?
No.
Yeah.
I think as long as it's done authentically and not as an act. Mm-hmm. You know, if your reactions are authentic and they're legitimate, then I think it's good to have those out there because I think people want to know who you really are, not who your advisors tell you to be.
Yeah.
And so I think that part of it's really good. Now, I think the president has taken it to a whole new level beyond where I was, and I don't know that I'd be totally comfortable with that all the time, but certainly I take my share of the responsibility for letting people know it was okay for political figures not to have to be politically correct all the time or be a heavy bag.
And was it annoying when you would have not just press, but just random people? I think of one particular video on YouTube where some guy's bugging you and your family on the boardwalk and he says some not so nice words for you. not good to be said in front of your kids. Not cool. What?
No.
How did you react to that?
I didn't react well that night. I went after the guy with, you know, while I was carrying my ice cream cone on the boardwalk, and it got a lot of publicity. You know, my communications director called me the next day, and she said, "Sir, I'm about to say words to you that I wished I never would have to say." And I said, "What's that?" He goes, "She said, I got a call about you from TMZ." You know, that's never good when you're a sitting governor. Yeah. But, you know, what I wanted to prove to people was, like, they could say whatever they wanted to me. Mm-hmm. But in front of my children, to use really foul, really inappropriate language was just unacceptable. And as a father, I was certainly not going to just allow it to happen unanswered, although the troopers made sure I didn't get too far.
It was that authenticity that I think made you one of the real rock stars in the Republican Party with a big national profile. And by 2012, there were a number of big GOP donors who were trying to draft you to run against Obama. To me, a Christie Obama matchup would have been a hell of a contrast. Why did you ultimately decide to sit 2012 out?
Ben, it seems like an antiquated thought in 2019, but I didn't feel like I was ready. I had only been governor for 15 months, and my own view was that I hadn't had enough experience yet. Mm-hmm. And
But and you would have been going up against someone who hadn't had any experience when he ran either.
You're exactly right. And that made me even more reluctant to run because I was like, how can I criticize him for being inexperienced when I myself am inexperienced? And so I just didn't feel like I was ready. And so I understood the political opportunity. Believe me, I saw it. I'm a pretty good practitioner of this business. I saw the opportunity, but I thought to myself, the only thing worse than running for president and losing would be running for president and winning and not being ready. Yeah. And so I just decided not to do it. And so I don't know. I think I would have won the nomination. I don't know that I would have beaten President Obama.
Really?
I said the other day, I think it would have been a jump ball. But you're right that it would have been a much starker and more clear contrast than between he and Mitt Romney.
Well, I'll tell you something. I think probably 2 weeks after the election, I was over at Frank Luntz's house. And he started reciting poll after poll in which he said that in a head-to-head matchup, you were the one Republican who would have beat Obama. Do you have any regrets about not running that year?
I really don't. You can't second-guess yourself about doing something that you believed in your heart was the right thing, right? So, you know, if I had made a political evaluation and made it based on that and then turned out to have that political evaluation be wrong, I would have lots of regrets. Yeah. But I just made the decision that 15 months as governor of New Jersey was not enough training to be ready to be president of the United States. Like I said, it seems antiquated now, but I still think I made the right call.
Now, days before the 2012 election, Hurricane Sandy hits and devastates your state. President Obama lands in New Jersey to assess the damage, and you two have the hug heard around the world, although you say it wasn't really a hug.
Suddenly, not even wasn't really. It wasn't a hug.
Okay. Yeah. Would you pat him on the back?
Or he patted me. Okay. Again, it was like, you know, we can go and it was one of the reasons I was tempted to put pictures in the book and then we decided not to because the picture is available from the White House and it's really pretty famous at this point. It's the president and I shaking hands at the bottom of the stairs of Air Force One, and with his left hand, he's patting my right shoulder. And I remember exactly what he said to me. He said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "I've had better days." Mm-hmm. And he said, "All right, let's go take a look." That was the entire conversation. And we never hugged. We never embraced. and you know, I was saying this in my speech today to these folks. It's one of the things that I think is really wrong with our politics today. I was civil to Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. He did a good job in Hurricane Sandy, and I complimented him for it. And I had more Republicans talk to me about that in my race in 2016 than I did about anything. Yeah. And this visceral hate for Obama inside the party brushed off on me because I felt like when I'm governor of New Jersey, my job is to represent all the people in my state. And they had lost 365,000 homes in 24 hours. Wow. And I needed the help of the federal government to be able to rebuild my state. And that doesn't mean I would say something about Obama that was untrue. He had done a very good job in the first few days of that recovery. But it also means that I won't wear my Romney sweatshirt and flash my Romney pom-poms. You know, I'm just not going to do that. It's disrespectful to the president, not the right thing to do.
Did you feel like you were treated like a little bit of a scapegoat for the Romney campaign's own shortcomings? Because lot of people were claiming that that was the reason he lost.
Which is ridiculous. Mitt Romney was never leading in a poll in 2 weeks leading up to the election.
Yeah.
So the idea that somehow he was going to pull it out after not being ahead in any polls 2 weeks going in is kind of crazy. But also, secondly, something that I write in the book that most people are not aware of is after Barack Obama left that Wednesday, I called Mitt Romney and I said, "Come Friday. You come on Friday. I'll take you on a tour. You survey damage. You meet victims. Bring a check for the victims' assistance fund. And we'll cancel out politically whatever happened with President Obama." And he said, sure, it sounds good. I'll have my people get right back to you to schedule it. And then his people called back and said, "No, we're not coming." So Mitt Romney has nobody but himself and his staff to blame for not winning the 2012 election. Certainly not me.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Governor Chris Christie when we come back in just a moment. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. and get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then, simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/kick. One more time, betterhelp.com/kick. In today's age, it can be hard to find the time to sit down and learn more, especially when the likes of social media can be so addictive and time-consuming. So you might think you don't have the time to read a book or to develop yourself. Well, think again. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways and need-to-know information, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library, from self-help, business, and health to history books. I like Blinkist because in less than 15 minutes, I can get the gist of a book or take a quick refresher course on something I read years ago. Plus, I'm an auditory learner, so I love that Blinkist allows me to listen. Not long ago, I used Blinkist to reacquaint myself with two classics, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, and Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. More recently, I just enjoyed the book Becoming by Michelle Obama and listened to Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now in preparation for my interview with Dr. Pinker. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for my audience. Go to Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. One more time, Blinkist.com/kick. And now, back to the show. Now, the other big test of your time as governor was this whole George Washington Bridge scandal. To your credit, you gave a nearly 2-hour press conference and answered every single question, and eventually you were exonerated. But you say it took your own son asking if you did it to convince you to actually speak out. And even after that, you got a call from George W. Bush. He's telling you how great the conference was. And then he says, just between us, did you do it?
Yeah. I mean, because if you remember, the coverage was so crazy, so insane. A Media Matters study got done for that month of January of 2014, and the Obama IRS scandal, Lois Lerner, was going out at the same time. And they said that in the month of January of 2014, the George Washington Bridge scandal got 17 times the coverage of the Obama IRS scandal.
Wow.
And 2 weeks after it broke, I saw Jon Stewart, the old host of The Daily Show, on the street in New York, and he's from Jersey, and he knows me. He came up to me and he said, how you doing? I said, well, I've had better weeks. And he said to me, you know, this coverage is insane. He said, I didn't know that you were already the president of the United States of New Jersey. And that's really the way it felt. And and I think there's no question in my mind that that's what cost me the presidency.
Yeah. Now, in the end, you said that it was a case of stupid people doing stupid stuff. Do you think the whole Trump-Russia collusion is going to turn out to be something similar?
Could be.
Mm-hmm.
Could be. It depends on who else Bob Mueller gets, if anybody else. But it could turn out to be that, because I don't think that this campaign, quite frankly, was organized enough to collude.
Really?
I really don't. I mean,
and you saw that firsthand.
I did. And like, I mean, there's a section in the book where Jared Kushner calls me on a Sunday afternoon in the last week of August and asks me, how many field ops do we need in Pennsylvania? And I said, well, how many do we have in Pennsylvania? And he said, well, we don't have any. Now, this is a state that Donald Trump had to win in order to win the presidency. There was no way you could win it without winning Pennsylvania. Yeah. And his son-in-law, who's supposedly running the campaign, is asking me how many field ops we need at the end of August with only 60 days to go in the election. I mean, it's that kind of stuff that shows you how disorganized and unfamiliar with the normal rhythms and texture of a campaign these folks were.
Yeah.
And so I don't believe that those same folks could run some kind of Tom Clancy operation with Russian intelligence to influence the election. I just don't buy it.
As U.S. attorney, you had dealt with both James Comey, who was the neighboring U.S. attorney in New York, and also with Bob Mueller when he was running the FBI. Do you think they're both men of integrity?
I think Bob Mueller is. Mm-hmm. I think Jim Comey's lost his mind. Really? I really do. Yeah, I mean, I think if Jim, Jim was my boss then at one point too. He was the deputy attorney general after he was U.S. attorney in Southern District of New York.
Oh, right.
And if I had ever done what Jim did, which was to announce no prosecution against a person, but then just absolutely berate them afterwards, all kind of adjectives about how irresponsible and how reckless her conduct was, he would have fired me on the spot. And he would have said to me, Chris, your job is to talk about the person who you can bring charges against. Everyone else you should be silent on. And that's the rule of the Justice Department. He broke it. He was insubordinate to the Attorney General. He's insubordinate to the Deputy Attorney General. He felt like it was his decision that everyone was waiting for. And I just would tell you, Jim is a much different guy than I used to know. And in fact, is so now ego-driven that it's hard to even get him on the phone. Really?
Wow. Now, speaking of silence, I think that your best advice to the president with the whole Russia matter is just don't say anything. And this is you speaking as someone who's been on the other side of these things.
I've been investigated and I've been an investigator. Yeah. And I said to him, there's no way you can make this shorter. There's lots of ways you can make it longer. So keep quiet. You see how successful I've been at that.
Yeah.
Not very.
Why do you think that he doesn't follow your advice?
He's incredibly frustrated, Ben. He cannot deal with the idea that he believes he did nothing wrong, that there's no evidence of having done anything wrong, and that now for 2 years he's been under investigation. And he's not built to deal with frustration. And so when he's frustrated, he lashes out. He has no other way to deal with it. And that's the way he deals with it. And I think that's a tough person.
At a certain point, you dropped out of the race and you endorsed Trump and you were made head of his transition plan. It doesn't sound like he likes transition planning. You said he thought it was bad luck, right?
Bad karma.
Yeah.
Bad karma. He used to tell me all the time, I haven't won anything yet.
Yeah.
Chris, he said to me, we're so smart. You and I are so smart that we could leave the victory party 2 hours earlier and plan the entire transition. He just did not like the idea of the transition
but
getting
it's
funded.
By law, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That was no moment to him at the moment he made it, because we had a former assistant United States attorney who worked for me who was, you know, dealing with a lot of this stuff for the folks involved. And he just would not get out of the way of anybody. And the president just, you know, wouldn't listen to anyone. No matter who I ran in his direction, he wouldn't listen.
Now, at a certain point, you're in this meeting with Trump and Jared Kushner walks in and tries to stop Trump from putting you in charge of the transition. Were you surprised? Did you think by then that stuff with the father was water under the bridge, or at least he had kind of made peace with it?
I thought he had. And I never met him up until that moment.
Oh, you hadn't?
Oh,
wow.
And by the way, your listeners will be shocked, I'm sure, to hear that I've never met Charles Kushner, his father. I prosecuted him, but I never met him.
Never saw him.
I saw him three times, and we never exchanged words. I saw him the day he was arraigned. I saw him the date he pled guilty, and I saw him the day he got sentenced. Three times, that was it. We never said a word between the two of us, so I consider myself having never met Charles Kushner. Jared walked in there for the first time. Yeah, I thought it was outrageous. I thought it was outrageous that this 30-something-year-old kid was coming in and airing ancient bitterness against me for having done my job, rather than being bitter at his father, who had hired a prostitute to run at his aunt and uncle.
Stuff.
I mean, really just awful, loathsome stuff. And, you know, the good thing was that day the president got it. I mean, the president just kept saying to him, he was candidate Trump then, obviously, but he kept saying to him, I don't understand why you're mad at Chris. He did his job. He was just doing his job. What did you expect him to do with all that evidence? Just not do anything? And Jared actually said at one point, it was really not a matter for federal prosecutors. It was a family matter for the family and the rabbis. And I just, you know, what I didn't want to do was dignify his attack with a response.
Yeah.
So I just ignored him and I only spoke to Donald. I did not speak to him.
Yeah. And I think you said that Donald Trump tried to get you and Kushner Sr. and Jr. all to go to dinner and make
pizza.
He
thought it was a great idea. In the middle of this whole presentation by Jared, he said, how about we all go out to dinner and just hash it out? And Jared's like, who are you talking about? And he goes, me and Chris, you and your father. And he goes, oh, Donald, I don't think my father's yet ready to have dinner with the governor. And I was actually relieved.
Yeah, I'm sure. You were on the very short list to be Trump's running mate. according to the book, you say that Trump kept calling you and asking, are you and Mary Pat ready for this? And even as Mike Pence was apparently landing at Teterboro Airport in your state of New Jersey, I know that there were these reports that even after he had told Pence that he was going to be vice president or be running mate, he had second thoughts and supposedly wanted to change his mind the night before the announcement. From your end, waiting for that call, did it feel like that's what was going on? Did you feel like he had made up his mind yet?
Oh, I absolutely did. I thought he made up his mind to pick me. And in fact, that Wednesday night when I write about the call where he said, are you ready? Mm-hmm. And is Mary Pat ready? About 3 hours later, I got a call from a very senior member of his campaign staff, who I don't name in the book because I don't want to out the person, who said to me, he just got off the phone with the family and told them you're the pick. And wow. Jared and Ivanka went crazy and told him he couldn't do it and couldn't announce it until they had one last chance for him to meet with Governor Pence, that they were flying their private plane out at 6 a.m. the next morning to go to a breakfast with he and Governor Pence. So I knew that I was not the choice of Jared and Ivanka, and that they wanted to do everything they could to prevent me from being vice president. Mm-hmm. And they ultimately were successful.
And it has to have stung a little bit because you were the guy who actually introduced Donald Trump and Pence. And worse than that, you're the guy who early on endorsed Trump and Pence endorsed Ted Cruz.
On both counts, I feel a bit aggrieved.
Yeah.
But you also know that you have no entitlement to the vice presidency.
Right. Sure.
It's the choice of the candidate. And so I was honored to be down to the last two. I think that I should have been selected based on a whole bunch of factors, but president made a different call. And if it was gravely influenced by his son-in-law, then he has to live with that too.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like throughout this whole process, there were a number of things that had his fingerprints on them, whether it came through Steve Bannon, who I think basically deferred to Jared.
He said, if you want to survive around here, you got to agree with the kid 90% of the time.
You were in the room during the election night. How did Trump's demeanor shift as the election returns started to come in? And suddenly, perhaps for the very first time, he started to think this thing's becoming real for me.
He got very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And after Pennsylvania was called, we were sitting in a room of about 100 people. And he looked at me and he looked at Pence and he said, let's go upstairs to the apartment. And I knew that at that moment he was feeling like, oh, my God, I really am going to be president.
Wow.
And I think it was an overwhelming thing to watch because the guy was, you know, one of the biggest underdogs in many ways ever to be elected president. And from my perspective, you know, it was a wonderful night. But he had to keep an eye on his own and keep a check on his own mm-hmm. emotions.
And I have to say, reading this book, you know, I have a lot of respect for you because you were very loyal to the president. You gave him good advice, served him well, and you're a good guy. But it sounds like you went through these recurring cycles, arguably probably at the hand of Jared Kushner, of getting close to being vice president, then attorney general, then RNC chair, only to have the rug pulled out from you at the last second. At what point were you finally just fed up with being jerked around and said, I'm done?
After the RNC chair, and I write in the book that I went up to see the president-elect at that point, and I said to him, he said, we're going to work all this out. And I said, no. I said, goodbye. This is goodbye.
Wow.
And I said, we've been friends for a long time. I'll always be your friend. I'll take your calls. I'll give you advice where you find it valuable. But I don't want a job here, and I'm just not going to be involved any longer. So thank you. And he said, no. Call me tomorrow and we'll work it out. And I said, go home, Mr. President.
Yeah.
And yeah, he went upstairs to his apartment in Trump Tower and I went the other way.
Yeah. He's a guy who always thinks that it can be worked out on a personal level.
The power of his personality is such that he believes if he got any of us in a room and tried to convince us of the exact opposite of what we believed, that he'd have a very good chance of convincing us. Now, he doesn't always, but that's what he thinks.
Yeah. To your credit, you also declined offers to be Secretary of Labor and Homeland Security because you didn't think you were right for those positions. If Jeff Sessions knew that he was going to have to recuse himself from the Russia investigation, do you think he owed it to the president to do the same?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that what he did was awful. Mm-hmm. I think what Jeff did to the president was just a terrible, terrible thing, not giving him full information about what he's going to do. That's why I believe that Jeff didn't recuse because of the campaign. Because if he had, he would have recused in November. You know, he would have told everybody then.
Yeah.
I think he recused because he got caught not telling the truth to a Senate panel about his interactions with Russians. That he got raised really high And he threw the president under the bus rather than take the heat himself. Wow. I think that's why the president was so angry with him. And I think that, you know, Jeff did not serve the president well, or quite frankly, the country well, mm-hmm. towards what he did.
Another person who you reserve particular scorn for is General Mike Flynn. You say that you knew he was trouble from day one. What alarmed you about Flynn?
Ill-tempered, no sense of self-control, self-aggrandizer, just all the things you don't want in somebody that's a really close aide. You know, you want people who are much calmer, much more in control of their demeanor, and not self-aggrandizing, but working for the team. Mm-hmm. And that was a bad moment. And then we did the candidate's first intelligence briefing after he was the presumptive Republican nominee. That was, he got to bring two people to those meetings, and he brought me and Flynn. And Flynn behaved himself in that meeting like a child, like a petulant child, interrupting, criticizing the other briefers, arguing with them, and just generally every kind of manner of showing off you can think of, yeah. were in his repertoire. And as a result, then, you know, they were no fans there. And that starts, you know, in July or so, June, July, of those intelligence briefings. And he does a number of them. And I think that when he got in trouble, there was no one in the Justice Department there to say, hey, let's give him a break on this.
So nothing surprised you?
No.
At one point, I think you say he even tried to convince Donald Trump to switch to being pro-choice in the middle of the
imagine
election.
Imagine that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was incredible. We were in the middle of debate prep, and he was like, I think what you should do, Donald, is you should just surprise, shock everybody, and just get up there and say you're pro-choice. It'll throw her off her game, and you'll gain a lot of voters. And Steve Bannon spoke up and said, yeah, for every voter he gains in the middle, he's going to lose three on the right. Yeah. This is not a good idea. And it was really what ultimately allowed me, when I took over debate prep for the second debate, to jettison him out of the room and not allow him there.
Wow. Before we go, there's a chapter in the book about your final day as governor. You say that after your successor was sworn in, you got in your car and the first thing that you did was go on Twitter and unfollow every reporter you knew.
I did.
How liberating was that?
Incredibly liberating.
Yeah.
To no longer have to worry about following 8 or 10 New Jersey-based state house reporters who were on my back for 8 years, most of them. So it was really liberating to let it go. And it was a good, not only think symbolically, but good for me internally to make the break.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't all following that. Them every day, finding out what they're saying now. I can care less.
Well, Governor, you're a good guy, and I hope this isn't the last we've seen of you in public life. The book is called Let Me Finish, Trump, the Kushners, Bannon, New Jersey, and the Power of In-Your-Face Politics.
Absolutely.
Governor Chris Christie, thanks for talking with me.
Listen, this is real thrill for me to be on Kick-Ass Politics. I'm a listener, and I'm happy to be on the show. And thanks for taking the time to talk to me about the book and about all the other stuff we discussed.
Thanks again to Governor Chris Christie for coming on the podcast. Order his book, Let Me Finish, Trump, the Kushners, Bannon, New Jersey, and the Power of In-Your-Face Politics on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow him on Twitter at Chris Christie. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.